The Philosopher's Zone, and today...
You are so, so cute.
Cuteness is a very powerful experience, and one of the signs of that is if you look at the way people lean over puppies or babies, men and women, they tend to coo. Oh, it's so cute. So cuteness, actually, the experience of it, is strong enough that it does something to our language. It actually affects the way we speak.
Not quite the sublime or the beautiful, though what it reveals might just be true. What is it for something to be cute? It might not move us to tears or promise to connect to something bigger, but it does tell us about modern times, if we care to pay attention. Sian Nye has been observing intently the mild, the mediocre, and the marginal, in art and in life. Sian Nye, welcome to the Philosopher's Zone.
It's nice to be here, thank you.
Now, I want to talk to you about the minor categories of cute and zany and interesting, but I noticed that your first book was titled Ugly Feelings. What was that about?
Well, that was about the aesthetics of minor negative emotions, not the powerful ones that have been the stuff of great literature, from King Lear to Moby Dick, rage, jealousy, and so on. But actually, the ones that, in contrast to these great passions, the negative emotions that don't particularly move people to action. So, for example, a mood like irritation or anxiety or paranoia. Feelings like these moods, as people like Heidegger and many others have pointed out, these sorts of feelings tend to lack clearly defined objects. So it's very hard to tell what exactly is causing your anxiety or what's causing your irritation. And these uncertainties about the nature of the object actually intensify the mood. The other feature that interested me was the ways in which many of these ugly feelings, in addition to lacking the catharsis that a feeling like rage can produce, that they're non-cathartic, meaning that they don't produce a satisfying sense of release or purgation. They tend to stick around, but they're also often feelings that are dysphoric to feel, meaning that they're unpleasurable to feel or that they're shameful to feel. So one that I particularly became interested in was envy. Envy is such a degraded emotion. The envier is always seen as being somehow suspect, even when her envy might be directed actually at a relation of inequality that actually exists. So emotions that are feelings that are either ambient, non-cathartic, don't particularly produce a sense of satisfying release, don't move us to action, or feelings that have a kind of ignoble status.
Yeah. So you've moved on to now look at cute, zany, and the interesting. I think you did write something separately on the merely interesting, which I have to say is a great category.
But, oh, thanks.
But tell me about the cute and the zany and the interesting and what they have to say.
I guess I became interested in these aesthetic categories because they seemed so ubiquitous. And I noticed that a lot of contemporary aesthetic philosophy really seemed, in a way, stuck in the 18th century in the sense of the main sort of aesthetic concepts that were always spoken about were still the beautiful and the sublime, which are clearly important and still with us, thankfully. These are wonderful aesthetic experiences, but didn't to me seem to be the ones that people use most frequently in their everyday lives. The cute is, to me, it seemed really important that it's a commodity aesthetic. It does have biological implications. There's a really famous essay by Stephen Jay Gould on the cutification of Mickey Mouse. But unlike the beautiful, there's no theory of the cute that begins with nature. The term starts to be used in the 19th century and reflects, in a way, the kind of arrival of commodity culture. The interesting thing to me about the cute was how it had a, you know, what you might want to call a dark side. And this goes back to the sort of main point about cute things being unthreatening, harmless, powerless. It's really important that the things that we find cute are things that are more powerless than we are. And I guess the darker side of the cute, as other people have also noticed, is that things tend to be cuter when they're passive, when they're injured even. There was a stuffed animal that was very popular in England after the Second World War, or maybe it was the First World War. It was this little stuffed toy called Little Mutt, and the makers of this stuffed animal realized that the stuffed animal was somehow cuter and more appealing if it had a bandage, if it had a little crutch. So there's a sort of sadism that's involved in the cuteness in our relationship to cute things. And I was interested in exploring that further. Also, in what happens when we call things cute, which is something that I hear people call things cute all the time, and it's not just teenage girls. it's everybody. Here's the other thing. Calling something cute is not necessarily a compliment. And that's the other thing about these aesthetic categories that was interested to me, is how ambivalent they are. Unlike the beautiful, which is a judgment that comes with certainty, there's a kind of an ambivalence about the perception of something as beautiful. It's not really clear if calling something cute or interesting is praise or criticism. It seemed to reflect a world in which people are generally less certain about their aesthetic judgments. And this seems like a huge violation of Kant's sort of aesthetic philosophy, but I don't think it is. I think there is this sense that the feelings that underpin many of our contemporary aesthetic experiences are often mixed feelings. People aren't sure exactly what to feel.
What does it say about our times, though? I mean, you've just put your finger on it. Perhaps you've suggested that one of the readings of this is that we're depowered in our capacity to feel something in that grand Kantian sense about beauty, being moved, the sublime. And so therefore we have cute and we have interesting, merely interesting. But you're saying that in fact it is a reaction to the times, but it's not necessarily a weak reaction. It also has its own form of power.
Yes, that's actually one of the paradoxes. It's important that these aesthetic categories are kind of trivial, right? I mean, cuteness, it's obviously trivial in the way that beauty is not. And this is one of the reasons why it's very difficult to attach spiritual or ethical claims to our experiences of cuteness in a way, since the ancient times in the West, moral or ethical or theological claims have attended the judgment of beauty or been attached to it. At the same time, cuteness is a very powerful experience. And one of the signs of that is something funny that happens when people often say things are cute and really mean it in a non-sarcastic way or a negative way, which is that they tend to coo this judgment. Oh, it's so cute. Their voices change. If you look at the way people lean over puppies or babies, men and women, there's a kind of interesting way in which the person who finds something cute, the way in which she or he kind of almost imitates the cute object, their speech gets softer, gets more infantile, more cooing. So cuteness, actually, the experience of it, which can be quite strong, is strong enough that it does something to our language. I think this is often unconscious. It actually affects the way we speak. So that's one way in which you could say that for all the triviality of the content, you know, taking aesthetic pleasure in something small, harmless, and unthreatening, there's a triviality to the content, but the actual experience can be quite powerful. And I think there have actually been some scientific studies showing that what happens in the brain when people react to things like babies and puppies, it's not that different from the way people respond to cocaine. So that's one aspect of the surprising power of these trivial aesthetic forms and judgments. Another example of their power is just their cultural ubiquity.
And what about the zany?
You know, that's an interesting one, because that's been with us for a very long time in some form or the other. You can actually trace the history of the zany all the way back to the 16th century. Commedia dell'arte, this Italian, it wasn't Italy back then, but what we now think of as Italian theatrical performance, which was half scripted and half improvised. But as a style, as a sort of cultural style, if you just cruise the internet for about 2 seconds, you will find something zany, you know, from game show hosts to even actually quite high forms of contemporary performance art. That style is with us everywhere. It's the style of, I don't know if you have this in Australia, but we have this sort of awful restaurant in the States called Chuck E. Cheese, which is sort of a pizza parlor for kids that has all these sort of games that people play. It's aggressive. This mouse sort of screams at you. And for the zany, what was interesting to me was, here we have an aesthetic category that is so explicitly about play, about fun, right? But at the same time, there's something unpleasant about the zany, right? I mean, it's a very sort of violent style. If you think here about Warner Brothers cartoons, right? There's something quite aggressive and unpleasant about the zany. And so once again, we have a kind of mixture of two clashing feelings at the heart of the zany. If cuteness is about tenderness, but also aggression, in the sense that we have this strange, sadistic, potentially sadistic relationship to our cute things, where the more injured they are sometimes, the cuter they are. With the zany, you have this concatenation of fun and discomfort or displeasure. And adding one more layer to this complexity, that very concatenation of fun and unpleasantness has somehow been experienced as pleasurable. Otherwise, how do you explain the longevity of this aesthetic style? The fact that you can see it on reruns of I Love Lucy, but also in certain forms of contemporary performance art.
All right, girls, now this is your last chance. If one piece of candy gets past you and into the packing room unwrapped, you're fired.
Yes, ma'am.
Let her roll!
Listen, Ethel, I think this...
Fine, you're doing splendidly. Speed it up a little!
Do you talk about what interesting and what zany tell us about the capitalist world we live in now? What are they telling us? I mean, you say that commodification is something to do with cuteness and performance is something to do with zaniness.
Yes, the zany is actually about work. And if you think about the zany characters, you know, in cartoons, they're working. You often get this image of a being of some sort that is besieged, that is uncomfortable, that is a being who is laboring in some way or another. And what's interesting is that there's a particular kind of work or labor that you could say that the zany is about, which is a concept of affective labor. Now, this is a concept that was really important to a lot of 70s feminists who use the term affective labor to describe the kind of work that women typically do. The work, let's say, of producing feelings in other people, caring labor is related to affective labor, but also the work of shoring up relationships, all of the sort of care work that women traditionally have done, which then feeds into the service industries. So with deindustrialization, at least in the United States, and the rise of what some people call post-Fordist or post-Taylorist work culture, where there's a sort of new management style in play. It's no longer the Taylorism, the scientific management of the 19th century, where workers were really asked to sort of break work down into these separate tasks to really act like machines. If you read management literature from, you can keep pushing it back, but let's just say from the 70s onward, there's actually, you can see a new style in place where workers are actually encouraged to play at work. I mean, I guess the epitome of this is sort of Google culture, right? The ping pong table at work, right? Work's supposed to be fun, and it's supposed to be about teamwork and cooperation and sociality. So workers, in a new way, are being asked to bring their abilities to play, to feel, and to be social, to integrate that into their jobs. And I'm not just talking here about white-collar jobs. What's really interesting is this is actually the case for factory jobs as well. There's a whole different organization of factory work as well. So if we think about the zany as work that is supposed to bring play and work together and to conflate them, we can see how the ambivalence of that aesthetic category reflects our ambivalence about this very situation. You could say, well, should people not have fun at work? I mean, should we return to, you know, the 19th century? Should people not bring their skills at socialization, their relational skills, their skills at being emotional subjects in relation to other subjects? Should they not put this in their work? That sounds strange. At the same time, I think there's an almost unconscious realization that this new conflation of play and work in so many postmodern workplaces, and even modern workplaces, has a disturbing side, which is that it can encourage the exploitation of work. Work comes to saturate the entire being of someone, their hearts as well as their hands, let's say, or their minds. Labor wants your heart too now. And so you can see how that ambiguity could reflect the way in which people are genuinely confused about whether these new developments are good or not.
On the Philosopher's Zone today, Sian Nye on those aesthetic categories peculiar to our age, the cute and the zany. And don't forget the interesting, which can be, I guess, interesting.
You're absolutely right. The interesting is interesting. What does that mean exactly? This was the most difficult aesthetic category to work on in many ways because the interesting is so devoid of content. The cute and the zany are charismatic. They call forth images immediately. There's something very tangible about these things, and we immediately can associate them with these qualities, right? So the zany is stressed out, it's violent, it's dynamic, it's moving, the cute is soft and pliant and so forth. But what qualities does something that is interesting have? Well, the answer is it's sort of a blank. There are no particular qualities that are associated with the interesting. And as you just said, this is what makes the interesting interesting. It is a curiously aconceptual, empty judgment in the way that is curiously similar to how Kant theorized the judgment of beauty, which involves pleasure without a concept, right? I mean, there's that famous moment in the Critique of Judgment where Kant talks about how the pleasure that underlies our judgment of the beautiful is disinterested pleasure. In fact, the disinterest is so radical that we don't know what the object is, we don't need a concept for it, we still feel pleasure, and in fact, we may not even have an interest in whether the object actually exists. So the interesting seems to be the diametric opposite of the beautiful, and that's in fact how it was theorized. One of the big surprises in doing the research for this book was I found out that the interesting has a history in philosophical aesthetics of being theorized by the German romantic literary critics, Schlegel in particular. And these guys immediately, intuitively opposed what they called the interesting, which was for them a distinctively modern and eclectic aesthetic of difference. They distinguished it, opposed it, made it antithetical to what they saw as the classical category of beauty. So the beautiful and the interesting are opposed from the moment that the interesting is, as far as I know, is first explicitly made into the object of a kind of literary theory or philosophy.
Nearly time for our favorite TV program, eh, Gromit? No, no, don't get up. I'll use my new remote control device. This'll save your legs. Oh, spot on target, and all from the comfort of my armchair.
These seemingly pleasant words have adapted perfectly to the hostile environment.
Now, I know that your next work is on the gimmicky, and I guess that that probably follows in line from some of these other categories. Is that correct?
It does. It's funny, because a lot of the things I work on, gimmicks, the cute, the zany, a lot of the artworks that we associate with these categories could be very easily put in a big drawer called kitsch. The gimmick, in a way, it's a device. The gimmick is a device for producing an intended aesthetic effect, and one that we feel to be dissatisfying. It's an aesthetically compromised form, right? To say something is a gimmick or gimmicky is always a negative aesthetic judgment. In a way, there's no ambiguity here, finally. You know, cute can be a compliment or it can be an insult, but gimmick is always an insult, right? Gimmicks repel us. They turn us off. They also do, however, exert a certain amount of charm or fascination, even if it's negative fascination. So why are gimmicks so almost comically irritating? Why do we find them so obnoxious? Why do they turn us off? And there's some interesting contradictions here in the gimmick as a form. On the one hand, I think we're turned off by gimmicks because they seem to promise to save somebody labor. The gimmick is a labor-saving device. It works quickly. When people refer to comedians using gimmicks, they're really referring to the tools of the trade of the comedian, right? The comedian has his bits, his gimmicks. These are time-saving devices, right? The bit is something that happens quickly. On the other hand, something about the gimmick seems to be excessively belabored. So on the one hand, gimmicks seem to be not working hard enough. I think we're irritated by gimmicks because the gimmicky thing is too easy. It's not working hard enough. It's taking some kind of shortcut. On the other hand, gimmicky things seem to be working too hard, trying too hard, right? Trying too hard to get our attention. This contradiction to me seemed really crucial. And one great example of this is the Rube Goldberg. He was a vaudevillian, a former vaudevillian and also a former engineer who in the first decades of the 20th century started to make these cartoons. And the cartoons were of these elaborate devices that involved many, many different interlocking parts. So a typical Rube Goldberg drawing, and these were just usually single panel cartoons published in newspapers, you have a bucket that drops a hot coal on a duck. The duck yells in pain. The sound of the duck's voice activates a pulley, which then triggers some kind of punching bag thing to, like, punch something. Anyway, these elaborate devices using many parts and very interestingly to me, using both inanimate parts and also usually either animals or small people. Goldberg often put small people in his machines. But here's the thing. Elaborate device, ridiculous. The device is used to do a completely ordinary task. So putting a postage stamp on an envelope or ironing a shirt, really, really simple tasks. But these elaborate, you know, effortful machines devised, that sums up the contradiction of the gimmick in a very beautiful way, I think, the Rube Goldberg. And the Rube Goldberg, it's funny, it's become a term. You know, people talk about Rube Goldbergs when they mean something that's sort of like a, you know, an overly, you know, laborious kind of device to do a simple task. I really think this contradiction is about one of the contradictions of capitalism itself, which is the way in which our machines do save us labor. But as everyone knows in some way, and you don't even have to read Marx to know this, these labor-saving machines ultimately cause the loss of jobs, underemployment, and they make workers redundant. So there's a double edge always to the labor-saving device in a very fundamental way in capitalist culture. And this particular contradiction of the gimmick, which is one of the things that makes it so irritating, is a direct reflection of that.
Not quite the sublime and the beautiful, but these are the times we're in. Sian Nye on the cute, zany, interesting and the gimmicky, and she's at Stanford. Details of her work on our program webpage, where you can listen again, download for later or read more. Thanks today to Diane Dean and Anne-Marie de Bettencourt. I'm Joe Gelonesi, and something equally interesting next week. Hope to see you then.
You are so, so cute.